Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 16th of September, 9:30 in the morning. And we thank you very much for being here. A great pleasure to have you on the program. And we welcome you all to it. We remind you that you can be a part of the program, and you can be a part of the program in two ways. One is you can, if you're knee deep in the conversation and you want to explore and you want to tell us what you think about the issues that you're talking that we're talking about, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. Now, just if you do that, we're not guaranteed that we'll read your letter. And not because we're screening them in any meaningful way. It's just that we get a lot of letters and more letters than we have time to read. And so we try to mix and get people who have, you know, original different things. So we get the mood of the room, I would say. Mood of the room. The other way you can take part is, of course, what Ray and Sarah were just talking about, and that is through the WAMC lockbox, which is open and needs your attention and love and support. If we are going to continue the conversations like we're having today and the conversations that we've had every day for the past 25 years on this program, we would love for you to take part and give us some time and realize that supporting WAMC is an important thing if you wish to have it continue. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and we welcome you to do that, and Ray and Sarah will be back in just a little bit. All right, let me introduce our fine panel this morning. I'm very excited for them. I don't know. I'm just excited. Editor at large, columnist, editorial writer, Times Union, for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz is not here. Hi, Jay. How are you?
I was not. You know, funny, I was just at the Spy Museum the other day in Washington, and that was my first thought. I think that was one of my posts. I was not here. you never saw me. I'm stranded actually in Washington, but thank you for making technology work and make it possible for me to be on the roundtable.
Well, we really want you to be. So how does one get stranded in a calendar year 2025?
One drives a 12-year-old pickup truck that is already starting to grouse about being driven, drives at 400 miles, and then discovers that the differential has gone, is going bad, and realizes it's not going to make the trip back because it is screaming at him. So we're in the process of selling the car in Washington, which appears like it's going to go through, and I will take a train back eventually and be done with it.
Well, the good thing about being semi-retired is that you have a little more, I assume you have a little wiggle room to be able to do things like that.
That is what my son pointed out when he could see this clear stress in my body language, my face, everything. He said, "Dad, you know, this is the great thing about being retired. You really don't have to be anywhere."
Well, we are absolutely one way or t'other. We are thrilled that you are with us, and we thank you very much for, if nothing else, we've given you something to do while being stranded.
Yeah.
So we thank you very, very much for that. It means a lot to us. Mike Spain joins us, former associate editor of the Times Union. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm great, and my car worked just fine coming in today.
Rub it in, Mike.
It from Schenectady County. Congratulations.
Jay, I can't even imagine you not riding, tooling around in that pickup truck. I've seen you driving it forever.
There'll be another one.
Yeah, there'll be another one. So here's something. We have I will say a new-to-me panelist. He has been on our program once before, but I wasn't here, and So Sarah got to work with him, and but I'm thrilled because he sounded great, and I'm very, very excited to welcome him to the program. This is his second appearance on our show, and we're really thrilled to have him. Biomedical engineer, principal scientist at Regeneron, of all places, and it's Ahmad Abu Hakma. Am I right in the pronunciation?
In the anglicized version, absolutely. if we're trying to say it in Arabic, I like giving this tutorial. It's Ahmed, and the letter ha doesn't exist in the English language. It is between a kha and a ha. So just imagine yourself very hot day having a refreshing beverage on the beach, and after you have that refreshing beverage, the sound you let out is yeah. That's where the letter lives.
And that's Hamad.
Ahmed.
Ahmed. Yeah. Ahmed. So is it okay if I go with the anglicized version?
That's absolutely fine.
Okay.
Otherwise, we won't get anywhere right now. But.
Well, you very quickly have figured that out. Yes. more so than other panelists. Yes. This probably as good as we're going to get. So from me, I'm of limited abilities. But I thank you so much for being here. It means a lot for us to have you here. So thank you very much. I look forward to digging into the conversations. Two news items that we won't really talk about at length, but first of all, Robert Redford passed away, and that is sad. We feel bad about that. Robert Redford, as Mike pointed out, did two films.
You know, we spent a lot of time in the Capital Region back in the early 70s. It was The Way We Were. It was filmed at Union College in Schenectady and up in Ballston Spa. And then he was back in Saratoga and Columbia County doing...
And
Washington County doing The Horse Whisperer, the great novel
right.
that got turned into the movie by him.
Yeah. Nicholas Evans, yeah. So our 89 years old and a great wife, accomplished much on screen and off screen, a great philanthropist and activist. And we send our respects to the family and the memory of Robert Redford. Also, on a 100% completely selfish note, also congratulations to the Philadelphia Phillies for clinching the NL East last night. They played the Los Angeles Dodgers. Because they played the Los Angeles Dodgers in Los Angeles, the game started at 10 o'clock. I figured, well, if this is a good time clock game, then I'm going to 2 hours. Well, it went into extra innings. So they're at 1:40. I'm still watching the game. But they won, and they clinched it, and they got it. And we're very, very happy. A second straight division title. But obviously a bigger fish to fry for my beloved Philadelphia Phillies. Okay, now let's get to the real news and things that are going on in our world. And I thank you very much for being with us. And again, you can join us panel at wamc.org. I want to talk a little bit about the new thing here seems to be what has happened since the death of Charlie Kirk is that there have been many proclamations by the White House and people within the White House to threaten liberal groups, saying that if you say things that aren't respectful, and I don't really know what that means. I'm not sure they know what that means, but I don't know what that means. Then they will crack down, and again, I don't know exactly what that means. But here's the official language. Charlie Kirk had a show. A podcast show, and yesterday it was guest hosted by the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, from the White House. So a lot of this comes from that, and while also President Trump and his top advisors threatening on Monday to unleash the power of the federal government to punish what they alleged was a left-wing network that funds and incites violence, seizing on Charlie Kirk's killing to make broad and unsubstantiated claims about their political opponents. Investigators were still working to identify a motive in the death of Mr. Kirk, a prominent conservative activist who was shot last week in Utah. The Republican governor in Utah, Spencer Cox, had said that the suspect had a, quote, leftist ideology, and that he acted alone. But Mr. Trump and a top ally suggested that the suspect was part of a coordinated movement that was fomenting violence against conservatives. And I just want to focus, for obvious reasons, on that term coordinated movement without presenting evidence that such a network existed. America has seen a wave of violence across the political spectrum, targeting both Democrats and Republicans. Mr. Trump, who has downplayed violence from the right wing and other supporters, said that he would like to designate a range of groups, including a loosely affiliated group of far-left anti-fascism activists known as Antifa, as domestic terrorists and bring racketeering cases against people funding protests. Mike, what do you and the First Amendment make of this?
Well, it does sound like an attack on First Amendment rights and the ability to say things. We've had the ability in this country to say things, however awful they are, with protections. But first of all, I just wanted to say, whether you were a fan of Charlie Kirk, whether you were very vehemently opposed to his political positions, or if you weren't paying much attention to him, his murder, the murder of Charlie Kirk, should be a time when people from both sides of the aisle stand up to denounce violence, period, rather than use it to foment more division, more distrust, making wild assertions. Vice President Vance, during his podcast or his show yesterday from the White House, was, you know, saying it's statistically proven that the left is more prone to violence, political violence, than the right. And there was one overnight YouGov online poll that suggested that right after the killing of Charlie Kirk. And that's not statistically sound. There's no other polls. There's, you know, I mean, and their polls go back and forth, you know, and there's a lot of data out there that would certainly dispute what he said. But just to use it, I think, is inflammatory. Even President Trump, before any suspect had been in custody and identified, was blaming the leftists. And I mean, it's sad that they are seizing this as an opportunity to divide people, scare people, which is very effective political rhetoric, you know, when you want to make them nervous and maybe come to your side and say, I'll protect you and I'll go after the bad guys. It's deteriorating rather than, you know, people who followed Charlie Kirk should celebrate his life. People who didn't follow him certainly should not be celebrating his death, and I don't think they are. I think it's exploitation of an event for the wrong.
Amen.
Yeah. So difficult situation, obviously. And I just want to start with what Hunter Kozak, the person who was asking Charlie Kirk the question at the time of his assassination, how he reflected in an interview. And he's like, I had obviously my ideological takeoff points and differences with Charlie Kirk, strong disagreements with him. But the shock that he had and put his hands on his head in the interview and said, is he not a human? Is he not a human? Despite our ideological takeoff points. And obviously feel for the family. He has two toddlers, young children, who perhaps will aspire to go to college one day knowing where their father was assassinated. That's a very difficult thing to deal with. Going to the article itself, it's very disturbing, obviously, trying to use this to go after what they... Obviously, we need to condemn political violence in all of its forms, but it's very problematic, the rhetoric that both Republicans and Democrats are using in this time. Republicans, obviously, Vance pointed out that he's going to use this to crack down on political violence. And if he wants to do that, then, of course, the first place to look is at yourselves. As you said, Joe, in the beginning, this has been said in previous episodes. People have made reference to January 6th. People have made reference to what happened to the elected officials in Minnesota and the very weak response by the White House and perhaps some people celebrating it. And then we have on the Democratic side, for example, just to survey Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, saying that he's afraid this is going to be used to criminalize dissent for those who differ with the company line of the White House currently. And I don't have a problem with that statement, but I have a big problem with it coming from Chris Murphy and his ilk, in the sense that those who have the nerve to talk about political violence after being silent for 2 years in response to the worst form of political violence, which is genocide, should be condemned. And that's both sides of the political spectrum. You know, the Democrats were in the White House in the beginning of the genocide against the people of Gaza, and their silence and their enabling of what was happening speaks volumes. Now, a couple other things to point out here. Note how horrific the assassination was. Note how that assassination was played and the algorithms continued to push it into our news feeds until it became more difficult to find. Note how he was humanized in his assassination. Now imagine if the headline said, and I'm just quoting something that Dr. Omar Suleiman said, imagine if the headline said, Charlie Kirk dies from a stray bullet. Charlie Kirk dies from a bullet and there's nothing identified. And the investigation goes uncharacterized for a long time. Because that's what the Palestinians have to deal with a lot. Imagine if, just like you saw the horrific assassination of Charlie Kirk, you had to listen to Hind Rajab's last words as 465 rounds were shot at her car and she bled out. Imagine if you had to see those images. So it's just a call to call out all forms of political violence, including the worst forms of political violence, if you want to be sincere in this investigation and path forward.
Thank you very much. Jay, I want to get your thoughts. I do have to take a break, so let me do that real quick. And when we come back, we will check in with you. And, of course, we always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about this effort by the White House and by conservatives and Republicans, basically the president and his top advisors, threatening to unleash the power of the federal government to punish what they alleged was a left-wing network that funds and incites violence, seizing on Charlie Kirk's killing to make broad and unsubstantiated claims about their political opponents. We got to all of our panelists except for Jay Jochnowitz. And Jay, what say you?
Oh, gosh. Before I get to what I would have said, I just want to key off something that Ahmad said about, the
Did
reference
he say
he made
it right?
to...
Much closer, yeah.
Good job, Jay.
Good job.
I appreciate the sincere efforts. I really do.
Was I close?
Yeah. You say something.
Ahmad. Yeah. The med is more like medical school rather than mod. Medical.
Oh, I even looked at the mail that Joe sent out to make sure it was MAD instead of MED.
Yeah.
Because I can get the huh, right, with a very Yiddish upbringing. Ahmed, okay?
Yeah, there you go.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right.
The reference you made to Murphy and the the broader issue that if you're going to talk about one violence, why aren't you talking about all violence? I think it's really an important point. you know, so much of what was on our list, on our reading list today, focuses on violence, whether it's Gaza, whether it's extrajudicial killings by the United States out on the open, out on international waters, whether it's the Charlie Kirk issue and so forth. And, you know, I think we are being desensitized as we, you know, go deeper and deeper into our political tribalism, that the only thing that begins to matter is party or ideology. And that is, and country, you know, and fear, which ultimately I think is what is going on here. You know, in the Charlie Kirk matter, that I think we have leaders who are exacerbating fear, hyping fear and then exploiting it. You know, a few days ago, we wrote an editorial. We published an editorial. I happen to be the one who wrote it. But we said in that editorial that, and I still stand by this, that if you're tempted to hold up a scorecard to somehow prove one side or the other is more prone to violence, think again. While in any given moment or year or decade, I would add generation, you know, one faction may seem more bloodthirsty than another, the broader sweep of history will surely disappoint you. And then we went on to list, you know, violence, you know, going all the way back to the mid 1800s, pre-Civil War. I still think that is valid, but I think in recent days, you know, we've listened to the president, and then we listened to this, what I thought was one of the most frightening podcasts I've ever heard led by the vice president, about how all this violence nowadays is coming from the right, from the left. And Thomas Edsel did a really great piece in the Times today that pulled together all the studies that have been done recently, and the violence is overwhelmingly, you know, there is just, as Trump would say, you know, bigly or something, there's just no contest here. The violence in modern times has been on the right. And then you know, depending on how you're measuring it, you can parse it the jihadists have run a second, and then Democrats a third, and then I think there's some others out there. I mean, I haven't, you know, to bring up Antifa now is just ridiculous. I haven't heard from them since the Black Lives Matter movement was in it, you know, at its peak a few years back. So this is troubling. But what Miller and Vance have brought up and threatened in recent days is have said to people in recent days, as I wrote about this and posted about it, that I don't like playing the Nazi card, but history is real important here. You've got, you know, you can take your pick, the Reichstag fire, you can, or I thought in this case, the better analogy was Horst Wessel. And I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that properly, and I'm sure a German listener will correct me. But Horst Wessel was a German Nazi figure who was killed, and they blamed it on communists. I don't think the murder has ever been definitively solved. He became the symbol of the Nazi Party and the fear that people should feel of communists. Things were named after this guy. He had his own violent streak. And I think in many ways, the right is trying to, I don't want to say that Miller is a student of history and is, you know, trying to pull the Horst Wessel card, but, or taking a model from this, but it is similar. And it's an echo of history that we really should worry about. I don't think this is just, well, an attack on the First Amendment, as Mike called it, is a serious thing, but I would worry about the depth of that attack, and I think we will see how serious they are about it in coming days.
When you look at the overall situation right now, I mean, this seems to be that they're striking while the iron is hot, but I'm just wondering about the other conversations that we should be having, even on the left, as to what needs to be said. And that instead of directly arguing the points that they are making, that we're doing the best that we can do, those who do not believe that there maybe is a network there, that we can do the best that we can do to be able to say what's on our mind, to be respectful, and to, and quite frankly, not become the target of these threats. Mike?
Well, you know, there were people who said some pretty vicious things after the death of Charlie Kirk that I think is horrible. And then there's people who came out and basically said, you know, I never agreed with Charlie Kirk, and this is why. I mean, there was a now famous article on the Nation website where Vance, alluded to yesterday during his podcast, where somebody was basically making the case that here's all the reasons I didn't like Charlie Kirk, but at the end said, but I'm in no way happy about his death, and it's a terrible thing, and mentioned maybe some of the personal things. You know, he left behind a widow and two children, and how ghastly that must be for them. And it's time to have empathy and not dwell on it. But, I mean, there were some people probably, I mean, there's probably a lot of people who said, Charlie Kirk, I heard his name. What was that guy doing? You know, and now they want to read about him. And it's perfectly legitimate to discuss his points of view. I suspect that if any political figure passed, they would have wanted people to remember them and talk about what they talked about. But where does it transition from calling out people who are being vicious and awful to calling out people who just note that they disagree with the political positions espoused very articulately and, you know, even handedly by Charlie Kirk when he was alive? I mean, why does one become the other suddenly? And it's too bad that people are being, you know, their names are being posted. There's, you know, like spreadsheets full of comments made by people in all different fields. And a lot of them are facing retribution at their employment, and they're losing their jobs and stuff. That again, it's not the time for that. The time is for recognizing that all violence against people is wrong and taking it from there. But it's time to denounce violence.
We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation with our brilliant panel after a short break and also a check-in at Lockbox Central right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Thanks to both Sarah and Ray for helping and the obviously working so hard on the Lockbox initiative. You can help out as well. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, to make your contribution. panel@WAMC.org if you would like to join in and share your thoughts on what we're discussing this morning. We do have some letters. I'd like to get to those, and then we can move on to other topics. No question left that Trump is not a normal politician, savoring the challenge of pluralistic debate, writes Russ. He seeks to enforce a bizarre sort of partisan purity over the electorate that tolerates nothing but support for his views. Every event, including an assassination or a demonstration to demand basic rights, is just fodder for his cause. That from Russ, we go to Roger. If people need to tone it down as far as wild assertions or promoting violence or being inflammatory, this should certainly apply to President Trump, who is one of the worst practitioners of such threatening, factually inaccurate comments. This ultimately leads to his removal from some social media accounts, as it did a while ago, and then starting Truth Social, which is anything but truthful and often incites violence, sometimes obliquely and sometimes obviously. That from Roger. Then, Kirk. The shooter was a far-right disciple of white supremacist Nick Fuentes and the online Groiper community. I do not know if that is accurate or not.
Yeah, I'm unaware of that. Yeah.
I am unaware of that, so I will throw that into as I read the letter. Trump and company want any excuse to go after the left, and it doesn't matter if it wasn't us, because they will just lie, and they'll base their and then their base will believe it. People are being harassed and fired for simply quoting Kirk's own words. This is blatantly opportunistic continuation of the same terrorism that Kirk was engaged in life, using his death as a convenient lever. That from Kirk. Then we go to John. Everything coming out of the White House is pure accusation in a mirror. And the tactic of accusation in a mirror is always used before those using it go on the attack to perjure their enemies. This is all too familiar to my husband, whose Austrian grandfather was hauled away to prison after my husband's mother had said that they had not, that the Anschluss had not improved anything, and she was 8 years old. That is where we are headed.
I just want to mention, Jay, you referenced Thomas Etzel's column today in the New York Times. One of the things he pointed out was that how quickly mass sorrow can merge into or morph into anger. And he gave the example of 9/11, you know, when people were all, I mean, the unity after 9/11 was profound and, you know, striking. And then within, you know, a very short period of time, 70% of Americans wanted to bomb Iraq, even though there was really no evidence and still is no evidence that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11 attacks. But you get angry and you want to blame somebody. And that is a tendency. It's a human tendency. And you want to hold somebody accountable and make them pay. But it's really a time for coolness and deep, you know, take a breath and step back from the and not succumb to that kind of rhetoric and the rhetoric, that kind of feeling, and the rhetoric that we're hearing is fueling that and really throwing gasoline onto that smoldering feeling that's already there. It's just a shame.
Yeah, and if I can just say one thing along the topic of unity, perhaps in something different than violence. Growing up in Jersey, I mean, I remember prior to Obama's second term, there was one of the tropical storms, it's eluding me the name, that hit the coast when Chris Christie was still the governor of the state. And I remember Obama calling him right away, seeing, what do you need? What help do you need? And this is, you know, Christie, who was basically pushing against Obama, along with the entire Republican base, in anticipation of that election. But all that was put to the side when that natural disaster occurred, and they were filmed embracing, and they put those differences aside, despite the fury of some of the Republicans saying, you're giving him the White House for the second term by showing this compassion for one another. Well, what else are you supposed to do in the face of a natural disaster?
Right.
Well, you know? In some cases, it becomes very political, and all you got to do is think about North Carolina, which had a horrible hurricane about a year ago on the western side around Asheville and in the mountains. And millions of federal dollars were committed to that during the last part of the Biden administration. And that's been held up.
Yeah, fed with an eyedropper.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Go ahead, Jay.
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Jay.
I was just going to say, you know, on this whole issue of, you know, unity versus division, I mean, Yeah, I take the stuff a little personally because I, you know, as a journalist, I immediately, you know, went to and I rarely do this because I learned many years ago how awful it is to do it. I went to the video and watched the video of the shooting, And I was it was wrenching to watch a human being being killed. And my first impulse was, this is wrong. This never should have happened. I've been dreading ever since the attempt on Trump's life in Pennsylvania. It's like, don't do this, people. This is not how we have these political arguments. And I think a lot of people, when this happened, both on the right and the left, were dismayed, just torn by it, that this shouldn't happen. It's not the way we deal with it. And we had a golden opportunity. We had a moment for unity here. And I hate to ascribe the worst motives to people, but I feel as if the political leadership in the White House, the people in the White House, this regime or administration or whatever you want to call it, just said, we can't have that. So they went about this crusade that was basically, and this is why I take it personally, it's almost rubbing our willingness to put aside the differences that we feel on Kirk and rub it in our face and say, you can't even say anything bad about him that is even true. And not only that, we're going to deify the guy. We're going to make him into a national icon. I mean, imagine if James Carville had been shot, or I go back to Keith Olbermann, who was, just a divisive character. If a Democratic president had said, you know what, I'm going to fly this guy's body to his hometown. I'm going to get it on Air Force 2 or 1 or whichever one you want to pick. I'm going to give him the Medal of Freedom. I'm going to name things in his honor. I'm going to do all this. And then to anybody that said anything wrong, someone like, a Democratic counterpart of Elise Stefanik said, we should investigate every single educator in New York State to check their social media accounts. That's 230,000 people when you add in the people who are AIDS and so forth. 250,000 that Elise Stefanik wants an investigation of to make sure they said nothing bad about Charlie Kirk. I mean, we have lost such a moment, just an opportunity for people to say, to come together and say, could we do this better? Could we, and as Joe said, could we just denounce violence? Could we focus on that? No, we can't. And I say that sadly.
Absolutely. We have other letters. I want to get to these in the few minutes we have before we go back to the lockbox. Deborah writes, could you please discuss the premise that if the Trump administration paid half as much attention to taking the steps needed? Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. I was thinking, I'm going to interrupt myself. I was just thinking of what you said, and about watching the murder. And I mean, it was shown on television, but it was edited, obviously. And I decided that I wasn't going to watch it, and I made the clear decision not to watch it, which eroded over time to the point where I felt that I should see it to witness it, to see what the people there had seen, and that in some way it wasn't smoothed over in any way. I watched it, and it's devastating, and it's heinous, and it's horrible, and it still bothers me. It bothered me for hours and hours and hours afterwards, to the point where you do get sick to the stomach, and I don't know how that's how you want, I think. Even the people who are going out and saying positive, saying things that are, I'm glad they did this or I'm glad they did that. I mean, my God, you wonder if they had seen it, and maybe they had, I don't know. But that seeing that, and you shouldn't have to. I mean, obviously, there's a large part of Christianity on this, of doubting Thomas, but looking at it and saying, wow, this is what happened. I can't imagine going forward and seeing that again.
Yeah, this is not watching a scene out of a movie. It haunts you. It stays with you. The last time I did this kind of research was probably 15, 20 years ago, and the images that I saw have never left me. You can't feel any joy. I can't imagine anyone feeling any joy after looking at this. Or any satisfaction or any justification or anything like that. This is the end of a human being's life. Terror.
We go to...
So don't take that away from people is all I'm trying to say.
Right, exactly.
The Stefanics and the Trumps and the Millers and everyone else. Don't rob us of our humanity, which is what they are doing. Anyway.
Deborah writes, could you please discuss the premise that if the Trump administration paid half as much attention to taking the steps needed to prevent school shootings, such as the one in Evergreen, Colorado, on the same day as the Kirk killing, then perhaps we could save our children from violent deaths at school. We then go to Kevin, who says, Charlie Kirk espouse stoning gay people. I take that personally. All children in school should take personally his opinion that some losses to guns will be okay to preserve the Second Amendment. He preyed on impressionable minds in his college audiences with his schmooze to hate the other, just like his mentor Trump and the uneducated. The violence against him is intolerable, but where do we really go forward with this quote-unquote debate? Then... Ariel writes to us and said, listening to Ahmed just now enabled me to breathe. I'm so grateful he is telling the truth on your program. If only we would feel and honor every child, every woman, every man in Gaza who has been killed or is being tortured to death by the Israeli government, as if each and every death was a brutal, unconscionable assassination. Because that is what has been happening since October 8th, 2023, and the United States steadily supplies to Israel weapons and money for arms is responsible. Words from our government do not matter. We need to block the bombs, which is the name of a current bill in Congress. We have needed to block the bombs every single day since Israel's assault on Gazans started. That from Ariel. Then we, a couple more letters here and then we'll move on. Donald Trump pardoned the January 6th rioters whose violence resulted in the injury of 142 police officers and two deaths, and also called them patriots. This makes him wholly unqualified to comment on anyone else condoning violence. Kathleen says, I couldn't agree more about what was just stated on the travesty and culpability of what is happening to the Palestinians. And I think I will end there. There is a letter asking about Charlie Kirk and that they had never heard of him and they want us to explain who he is. I would ask you to go and look. And what I would recommend is, if you can find it, and I don't think it'll be that difficult, but the New York Times did a very clear, thorough, and I think very well-written straight obituary on Charlie Kirk. And if you find that from the day, which would have been the 10th, I believe, that is a good place to get an idea of who he was and what... and the influence he held within political circles. All right, so let's go to some other things before we go over to our break in just a moment. And I want to, and again, we welcome you as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So, of course, the big story is this Israel launching ground offensive in Gaza City, hundreds of thousands of people remaining in the city with hardly anywhere to go. Israel said the ground operation after nearly 2 years of war was needed to help Hamas militants from regrouping. This is updated from the New York Times just about a minute ago. The Israeli military said on Tuesday that it had launched this ground incursion into Gaza City overnight, embarking on a risky operation to take control of a key urban area, even as hundreds of thousands of Palestinian residents remain there. The ground operation and intensifying Israeli bombardment are deepening the humanitarian crisis in Gaza in a nearly two-year-long war that has already killed tens of thousands of people. Palestinians in Gaza City describe scenes of panic as Israel pounded the area with heavy airstrikes. Israel's military said it had attacked the military infrastructure site linked to Houthi fighters in Yemen just a few hours after warning it would strike the area. And, of course, another question, which I will mention, is where will people in Gaza City go? The Israeli military said on Tuesday that roughly 500,000 people remained in Gaza City after 350,000 had heeded evacuation orders and fled as Israel launched a ground operation in the city. Amen.
Yeah, so this is following a discussion on a political assassination, and so I want to bring in a greater political assassination in our history to frame this, and that is that of Dr. King. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., obviously assassinated on the 4th of April in 1968. A year prior to that, he said, the autopsy of the United States, if an autopsy was done to the United States, that it would read Vietnam. And he had written a speech and penned a speech that he was not able to give because he was assassinated prior to giving it, and it was titled, Why America May Go to Hell. And I say this because what he framed his speeches on was along the lines of, yes, you built buildings, but what did you do for the poor? You did not see the black child that was struggling. You did not see those who were struggling in your proximity. And so the United States, with Rubio in his latest visit to Netanyahu, has continued to beat the drums of war, has shown that we are completely okay with whatever you're saying, with whatever you're doing in terms of the genocide in Gaza, has walked back the criticism, the very flimsy criticism that they voiced a week or two ago. And the reality is, linking with what Dr. King said, the language that is used is intentionally used so that we do not see the beheaded Palestinian child, but we see the propaganda of the Jewish children who were not beheaded. We do not see the Palestinians who are being held, men, women, and children, in detentions as hostages, where they are raped and abused and have their bones broken any way possible. We don't see them as human beings, and so we cannot feel like we felt for what happened to Charlie Kirk. You see, I don't think that Israel or the U.S. want peace in this region. They want complete destruction of the people of Gaza. And they can bomb whoever they want. They can do whatever they want. And the Palestinians will be left to suffer. We're saying, where will the Palestinians go? Remember, Gaza is the size of Los Angeles Airport. It's tiny. And 70% of the inhabitants of Gaza are already refugees from 1948 and 67. And so we hear these articles of they're fearing permanent displacement. They've already been permanently displaced. They've already been permanently displaced. And so, you know, when you read Rubio's rhetoric and that the objective remains to release the hostages, explain to me how this is going to happen. Explain to me, do you see Palestinians as hostages at all? Do you see them as hostages at all? And he says, yes, we need to secure a better future for the Palestinians, for the people of Gaza. He doesn't use the word Palestinians. We need to secure a better future for the people of Gaza. But recognizing a Palestinian state is not part of that equation, as he condemns those nations who do that. Because, of course, the Western world, we know what's best for you. Trust me, destroying your hospitals, destroying your mosques, destroying you while you sniping you while you are getting food and starving at a humanitarian site. Trust us, this is for your liberation. We destroy your past and your future so that you have a future, is essentially what Rubio is saying. And this is utter nonsense. I'll stop there.
Yeah, you know, Joe, it seemed like when Rubio was dispatched after the White House was clearly unhappy with what was going on with the plans to move the military into Gaza, that was the message he was supposed to deliver. And I don't know what was said behind closed doors, but as he left, you know, the reporters asked him if the U.S. supported the operation that's going on this morning or today against Gaza by Israel, and he said, it's their war. And then he headed out. He's heading up to the U.K. where right. there's a state visit, so he can go along with see the king.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And just a few minutes before we have to go, but I want to get to Jay Jochnewitz on the subject we were talking about just before the break, which is the Middle East crisis and the what is happening, the Israeli troops pushing into Gaza City and forcing desperate Palestinians to flee. We've heard from two of our panelists, and Jay, that leaves you.
Thanks. I think one of the headlines that the Times had on this at some point during the day was that Rubio went to Israel as, you know, amid Trump getting more frustrated with the situation there. And I had to roll my eyes. There's an old saying, always worth remembering in this particular administration, but in politics in general, is you look at people, what people do and not what they say. And, you know, every step of the way here, they have allowed Netanyahu to do pretty much whatever he wants. It is one long, slow genocide going on. And the UN has declared it that now. You know, and what frustrates me is that every step of the way we have watched, we've seen these, you know, very tentative declarations of atrocities. You know, this appears to be a war crime. And then, yeah, okay, it was a war crime. And it appears that, you know, a famine may be developing here. And then, you know, little by little by little, we finally have, yes, there is a famine. And the same thing with genocide. Every time there is a pronouncement like this, Israel pushes back, the Trump administration pushes back. None of this is as serious as anybody says, or we have to get rid of Hamas. And that is the bottom line, even at the cost of 2 million Palestinians, if it's going to come to that. And it's just Trump could have put pressure on. And so could Biden have done so. They could have put pressure on Netanyahu not to go this far. And, you know, when people say Trump's frustrated, you know, I think he's frustrated that he can't get his seaside development done fast enough. I mean, I'm just so disgusted with this situation at this point. And, you know, Israel's latest offensive is, I don't know if it's the last that they're going to do. I don't know if this is going to be the final destruction of a key city in Gaza, but and a lot of people who can't get out, and the death of those people. I don't know how much longer this administration can play the game that they're playing of sitting, you know, squarely on the fence.
We do have a couple of letters, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC. Stephen writes, please make clear that a large percentage of Jews here and abroad despise what the Netanyahu government is doing. How is that, and how can that be expressed, do you think?
Well, I mean, some of the work I do, I work closely with folks from Jewish Voice for Peace in Albany. And I mean, I just think doing meaningful interfaith work. I mean, I'm a person of faith. I'm Muslim. You know, a lot of times interfaith has been reduced to getting together and having nice food from each other's cultures and then leaving the elephant in the room, not discussed. I mean, that's not meaningful. Getting together, regardless of your faith or non-faith, and talking about the most pressing issues and uniting because of the values you have in your respective faiths or non-faith, is important. And I am encouraged by, you know, the work that I do with Jews in the Albany, greater Albany area, and as well as Christians and other folks from different parks, walks of life. And that's a growing population. That is a growing population who are absolutely fed up and want nothing to do with supporting a genocidal machine.
I was struck by a headline. The headline that I initially sent out, this is before the latest of what we're talking about this morning and the attacks. But the headline being Rubio in Israel meets Netanyahu as Trump grows impatient.
That was the one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you were talking about, right, Jay? I mean, that's.
Yep.
Like, what do you do with that?
It sounds like good cop, bad cop. You know, it's an act. I can only assume it's an act in the absence of a change in what's happening here. If the American president was really growing impatient with Israel, Netanyahu would change his tune. He would change his tactics. They would find a way to work this out.
How
not
would that
work
look?
It out. I'm not saying work it out with Hamas. I'm saying they would find a way to de-escalate this and end it, and then deal with Hamas separately the way Israel has for many years dealt with Hamas. And at this point, you know, an organization as deteriorated as Hamas is at this point, could be dealt with in many other ways than an all-out war against civilians.
What would how would that look in Washington? I mean, what would it take for that to happen? Would it be a public denouncing of the war against Gaza, or what would it be?
Yeah. It would have to be an expression from the United States to say we are. This has gone on long enough. And to find a way to not make it look like they're doing a complete 180. But you know, your question presumes that the kind of people around Trump are the kind of people that Ahmed and I talk to, who are appalled by this. And I don't think those people are anywhere near Trump. I don't think he's got any voices in the room that would. Yeah, you know, I don't know that he's got any voices in his room that don't wait for him to say something and then just agree with it. I don't see it happening, unfortunately. Maybe if it happened in Congress, you know, from leadership in Congress, not the minority, but from Republicans in Congress to say we're appalled by this, maybe Trump would get the message, but they're not going to buck him either. So they're just taking their cue from one man. It all comes down to the president.
Yeah, and then just, Jay, something you said earlier, basically actions speak louder than words. I mean, you can give something in words way more powerful than your frustration and impatience. But you can also take some actions, like not sending them weapons to rip people that look like me apart limb from limb. That would be important.
Yep.
I want to talk for just a moment because we have to break. But, Mike, you mentioned the meeting that's taking place in the UK and the state visit. Which, according to the BBC, is mired with potential pitfalls, even though there is very careful planning, and saying that it was, they're ready for this. They're trying for it to be as smooth as possible, but they're ready for the controversies.
Yeah, I mean. I hadn't realized the depth of the various aspects of this time, having a state visit I guess Trump is going to go in for like less than 2 days and get in there and go to a dinner with the king. The king is going to give a 7-minute speech. It's all being orchestrated, and they're trying to avoid some very awkward kinds of disagreements that are on the table, the tariffs, the fact that Lord Mandelson, who was the ambassador to the U.S., has been yanked from his position. He was closely associated with Jeffrey Epstein, so they wanted to get that out of the way before Trump came, so there wouldn't be any questions about that. So you have that awkwardness of one good close friend of Jeffrey Epstein getting ousted from his role in the U.K., government, and you have the president of the United States coming, and he's another former close friend of Jeffrey Epstein, and that's awkward. And then you have the fact that the UK is about to declare its support of recognition of Palestine as an independent state to kind of push forward the two-state solution that the U.S. doesn't seem to be espousing anymore, and that Israel is trying to stop. And that was the plan. Awkward.
Yeah. So, I mean, what can go wrong? Look at the equation. You have the U.S., you have Britain. You have them sitting down at one point to talk about taxes and tea, you know, while they're having tea. What could go wrong?
Well put. <Yeah. laughs>
It's worked well over a period of hundreds of years. Jay.
I love the juxtaposition that Mike just brought up on getting rid of a guy who was a close associate of Jeffrey Epstein at the moment that Donald Trump, a close associate of Jeffrey Epstein, is coming for a state visit. You know, it's almost like a statement that for everything we say, everything that we do in the next few days, this is what we really think. You know, and it's interesting. It'll be, you know, I've never been a royal watcher. I once had to write a story about the Queen's visit to Canada when I was in a bureau up on the northern New York border, and it was fun. As a colonist, former colonist, you kind of roll your eyes at this adoration and fascination with the royal family. But I have to admit, I will be interested to see how that speech navigates all the pitfalls that, and all the things it has to overlook and all the things it has to nuance to not be an embarrassment to the president and not hurt the or not cross the line that British monarchs can't. Or aren't supposed to anyway, in terms of being political. It's almost like having Trump there is a political statement in itself, but I think everybody understands that our allies are actually a little more self-aware and a little more concerned about the long term than maybe Trump is from day to day about relationships,
Jay,
and so forth.
I got to run. I apologize.
I'll let you go.
But I thank you all. Thank you very much. Hope you get out of Washington. Delight to meet you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mike. We'll be back right after this.